Good morning from HPR2. It's The Conversation for Thursday, March 13th. Election 2014 is a little over 7 months away. Tomorrow, the legislature will hear two bills that could affect how results are certified and when campaigns have to report. Gary Camm of the Campaign Spending Commission looks at the changes the bills would bring if they make it to the end of the session.
Climate change legislation was part of the joint majorities package. Blue Planet's Richard Walsgrove gives us an update on where some of those bills stand now. And singer-songwriter Ken Makuakane's love of Hawaiian hymns turns up in his workshop on Kauai. What do you get when you cross zoo lovers with kids who read books? You get wild about reading, and we'll find out why with author Sue Cowing. I'm Chris Vanderkoek.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Those conversations and a few more coming right up after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkoek. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Oh, good morning. I mean, I'm just listening to Rock Lobster. I haven't heard that in a very long time.
The 80s was a dark time for music.
Yeah, and considering that basically our crew on the other side of the glass there really wasn't there in the 80s. So I guess they're
lucky
enjoying it a first time around. Anyway, good morning to you too.
Good morning.
So we're going to pick up with a conversation that we've been having periodically, it seems, for quite a while, and talking about a little bit of what it means to have election success. That often can mean the meeting of opportunity and timing, as we've talked about before. But now it could also mean compliance with changes in the reporting of campaign finances and the payment of any fines due to the Hawaii Campaign Spending Commission. Several bills from the commission's legislative package are still on the move and will be heard tomorrow. In advance of that, Gary Camm, the general counsel for the commission, is here with an update. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
It's tempting to kind of look at these bills and say, okay, this is all about housekeeping. But in some ways, it really seems if it's not. There's more to it there. Or am I misreading this?
Well, the HB 1602, the first bill, I think it's a bit more than housekeeping, although I think you could construe it to be housekeeping in that it is concerning the supplemental report that is due on January 31st for candidates and non-candidates. Right now for candidates, the law currently says that the report is due on January 31st after an election year. So what we're trying to do is remove that language after an election year, so it's clear that January 31st report is due on each and every year, not just after an election year.
And that has ramifications in terms of if that were not to happen on an annual basis for how the commission could behave, which is why I asked you sort of, you know, it's tempting to say that it's housekeeping, but really when you look at those four little words, they're just, you know, so potent, and there's so much meaning in there for what has to happen with the Campaign Spending Commission.
Yeah, you're correct. I agree with you. I guess the reason why I said it's sort of housekeeping in that candidates already file that report on January 31st of every year. The problem that that we face is that with the statute, the language, the way it is, we may not be able to enforce that disclosure report during an election year, for
and
example.
And that's the problem.
Now, yes, and that is the problem. We've decided that we won't go to court on candidates that don't file that report during an election year simply because of the language of the statute. But, of course, that's going to change if we can get that amendment to take out after an election year. Then we'd be able to enforce that particular report each and every year.
Gary, that seems like a big if, given the fact that, you know, this has been tried several different times and never happened.
Yeah, we've been trying to get that statute amended for the past two sessions. The House has passed it, but the Senate has not. So that's where the bill's been stuck.
And any reason why?
I don't know. Maybe some candidates might feel that it's requiring an additional report.
But not if they're doing it anyway.
They are currently doing it. So then I guess to answer your question, I don't know what would be the objection to that.
Which might be a reason to ask them.
So far we, last year at least, when the bill came over from the House side, I think it was House Bill 211, that we didn't get a hearing on the Senate side. So this bill, 1602, is currently scheduled for Friday. So we'll see.
Let's look at the other one, the 1604.
Okay, 1604 deals with the conditions on a winning candidate receiving the certificate of election. Once the results are certified, the candidates are issued a certificate of election, and they need that to be sworn in. Currently, election law states that if you don't have all of your expense statements filed, submitted to the Campaign Spending Commission, then you don't get the certificate of election. So what we're trying to do in this amendment, one of the things we're trying to do is get that the term expense statement change to reports, because in the campaign's finance law, you know, we deal with reports, disclosure reports, and that the term expense statements actually does not exist in the campaign finance law. So just to keep the language in the election law consistent with the campaign spending, we want to change that to reports.
But more than that, this particular bill would also say that you have to have paid your fines to the Campaign Spending Commission.
Yeah, the other amendment to that election statute is that in addition to having your reports filed, you would have to have paid any fines that had been levied by the Campaign Spending Commission before getting your certificate of election.
What went into putting that into this bill?
Well,
I mean, it seems logical enough that somebody should have to be clean and having done everything that he or she is required to do to be able to get that certificate of election. But why is it that we're focusing now so much attention on paying the campaign finance commission's fees?
You know, in addition to getting candidates to file their disclosure reports not at all, and also on time and just filing it at all, the other issue that we dealt with is having candidates being assessed fines and not paying them. So we felt that if we did this kind of an amendment, it would be an incentive for winning candidates to pay the fine.
And what have you got in the way of a little bit of controversy over that? Anyone upset that the fact that they would have to pay their fines before they would actually be sworn in?
Well, you know, because that's not a requirement. No, there has been no pushback yet.
Yet.
Right.
Meanwhile, tomorrow these are going to be heard, both of them.
They're currently scheduled to be heard tomorrow at 10 before the Senate Judiciary and Labor Committee.
So if anyone wants to weigh in on that, there's an opportunity. But so far, this seems to have the same kind of support that bills like this always have, you know, sort of the good government people who are behind many of these bills and have been trying to make these changes. Do you feel if this year might just be the one, after having tried it for several sessions, that this will happen?
Well,
not that you can prognosticate
you know, like
any
I
better
said,
than
as far as 1602, we'll see. As far as 1604, yeah, I'm hopeful. I think anyone would expect their elected official to be in compliance with all of the campaign finance laws in order to be eligible or qualified to sit as an elected official.
One would hope, but given the fact that we're talking about this now, it means that we have a backlog where that necessarily hasn't happened.
Well, it's not a big backlog. If you know, if we were to apply that law, I have to check, but between 4 and 7 candidates, it would affect.
But enough, but just enough to be able to make sure that everything were to be on the up and up from the point at which a person took office.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to see what happens with it this time around. And thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Gary Kim is the Counsel General for the Hawaii Campaign Spending Commission. Before that, he was a Hawaii Deputy Attorney General. The two Campaign Spending Commission package bills that we talked about are up for hearing tomorrow. They're listed on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, where you can also chime in. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13, and coming up, the Hawaiian gift for music applied to Christian hymns, the tradition of Nahimene. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, the University of Hawaii at Manoa may be the largest university in Hawaii, but it's by no means the only option for those seeking higher education in our islands. Hawaii has a growing university community that is rapidly building traditions of its own, traditions that go back farther than you might think. Here on Oahu, thousands of students attend two schools that were founded in the same year, Chaminade University in Kaimuki and Brigham Young University on the north shore of Oahu. BYU Hawaii is a private university in Laie that is owned and operated by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Chaminade was founded by the Society of Mary, the Marianists, as St. Louis Junior College. Between them, they have more than 5,000 students. And for this morning's backyard quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the year both Chaminade and BYU Hawaii were founded. Stay tuned for the answer in the second half of the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bush Consulting, providing IT support, customized network services, and backup recovery for Hawaii's businesses since 1990. Learn more about outsourced IT at buschconsulting.com.
Still looking at the impact of religion on Hawaii, the next conversation considers one of the richest offshoots of Hawaiian music, Nahimene, hymns that were created, are adapted, to the Hawaiian language. It's a tradition rich in history, and Ken Makuakane, multiple hoku-winning musician, is offering a workshop and a concert of hymns this weekend on Kauai. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Ken.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, it's always seemed to me that the world of the 19th century Christian hymn was very major chord harmony, very kind of open melodies. It always seems that was made for the Hawaiian music ear. They seem very compatible to each other.
They're very, very compatible. The music that we have today with your verse, chorus, pre-choruses and bridges weren't prevalent back in the 19th century. You know, we mostly had four-line verses or four-line verses with a short chorus, and that was the style of music back then.
And those four verses would kind of tell an ongoing story, right? I mean, the lyrics would be sort of build on each succeeding verse. Yeah?
Actually, that's actually true, because when the missionaries came over, they brought with them their music, and so it was translated into the Hawaiian language. And so we miss the actual writer's perspective because we're singing it in Hawaiian. And so that's the crux of what this workshop is about, is to reintroduce the original composer, how they got that inspiration or mana'o, and how it got translated into the Hawaiian language.
Whenever you do any kind of music, it's really important to understand the intent, don't you think?
Oh, you know, as a songwriter.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the reason why I started doing these things, is because people are singing the songs, but they don't know the intent of the music or the lyrics.
That's so true of any kind of music, don't you think?
Unfortunately, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
You know, so when you hear the artist, you go, oh, that's so-and-so's song, but that really isn't. They're singing a song that someone else wrote.
Yeah, and it's kind of like the author of a play. You really want to get to a story that, you know, started with somebody wanting to tell a story.
Right, and, you know, basically it's, unfortunately, unless you get really famous like Stephen King or that kind of sort, you know, they're kind of anonymous, and the lead actors or whoever is doing the drama piece are...
Sure.
Are the ones who get the kudos for it.
But it's obviously important to you to get back to that intention when you, before you do a song, yeah?
Right. We always say, you know, you got it doesn't start with the end. It starts at the beginning. and the beginning is the inspiration. So yeah. What brought the song about, and then what was the song talking about, and how does it translate the message to the ones who are hearing the message?
You know, it makes it so much easier to perform a song once you get grounded that way, don't you think?
Always. And you have to believe the song in order to exude that exact inspiration.
And, you know, I mean, that could apply equally well. I feel that same way about songs by Muddy Waters.
Oh, there we go.
You know what I mean?
Now we're talking.
You need to, you get to, it's a person that you're talking about, a person with a story to tell.
Right.
And it can be any kind of story.
That's exactly it. You can have 1,001 people singing the same song, but why is it that one artist just captures that whole emotion? Take, for instance, Is.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that anybody else did, but when Is the Over the Rainbow, with just one voice and one ukulele, all of a sudden you could hear the heart of it coming out because, you go, it seems like he wrote it because he believed it and he sang the way he believed.
Yeah. That's the way to do one, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, let's put a song in here. If this is from the 19th century hymnal Nahimene.
Yes, and it's a song called Nawimai Kikula Sabati, which means come away to the Sabbath school. So we call it Sunday school. And the backstory is that Sunday school was actually created for criminals or prisoners way back when, and it's to bring moral back into their lives. And so they had to, on Sundays, go to this school to learn morals, moral values. And so that's how Sunday school started.
Wow.
Nani no ka po mai kai, ma ke kula sabati, nawehe, nawehe, nawehe. Hui ma ka pulehe, me ka mele himeni, nawehe, nawehe, nawehe. Mai kai no na kumua o nawehe. Mena pukea o apau na we Ama laila no wa'a Veka mene himeni Na we, na we, na we. And that's a song for...
That's a delightful melody, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very catchy. Most of these tunes in the Nahimene are catchy tunes.
Well, you know, I just sort of guessing without knowing what the words meant, it had a sort of a come along with me, joyous kind of a feel.
Right. It's beauty is the blessing of Sunday school.
Kind of, this is a good thing, get on board and come along with me.
You right. Know? You know, the people always split, you know, what they call religion and state apart, but I call it a diet. You know, it's a way of living. Some people, you know, you look at that with food, and it's the same thing with your moral values. Mm-hmm. And I always like to say, don't change legislation, change morality, because you can't police everything.
Yeah.
But you have to allow the humans to know what and develop the right and wrong characters of their
taking
lives.
An inside out approach instead of an outside in approach. Well, you're obviously, you know, for you, music is something more than just, you know, arranging sounds. It's about a message. I mean, words are essential to what you do.
Right. And all of us have what we call a gift. And a gift isn't something that we own. It's something that was given, you know. And so you start to develop your gift, and everyone's gift does not open all the way, you know, as you go along in your life's journey, it keeps unraveling and unwrapping, which means that Like, for instance, my dexterity on my fingers, you know, from practicing and practicing, it gets better.
Yeah.
And just like the development of songwriting gets better and better as your journey goes on. So we have a gift that constantly develops, and everyone has that kind of gift in whatever they're gifted in.
I've always thought it was, you know, one of the great things to me about being a musician is you, at least there's one thing in your life that always gets better, right?
Oh,
if,
yeah.
If you practice, you will be rewarded. It's a very cut and dried kind of a kind of a thing.
And I believe that we have many gifts. We just choose to emphasize one particular one, but we have many.
And yet it's a shame when you see a gift being squandered.
Oh, boy. Especially in the music business. I've seen it my whole career.
Well, you know, you can easily fall into the pitfall if you have a gift and people tell you about it and you know about it. There's a temptation to lean on that, you know, and not hone your craft quite as readily as you might. That's where you can kind of fall astray. Yeah?
Exactly. And that's why for me, you know, I work for the Hawaii Conference United Church of Christ. And for us, the glorification or honoring, you know, when people go, oh, wow, you're great. You know, we always turn to the higher source because I believe I'm the conduit. I'm not the definitive. And so there's always a higher source that I pay homage to.
And that obviously, you know, informs your art, Ken. I really appreciate talking to you this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
Oh, well, you know, and just to reiterate, you know, we're doing the Nahimini workshop on Saturday at the Hanapipi Congregational
Church.
We'll
send people your way.
Thank you. From 12 to 2. Mahalo.
Ken Makuakane has 14 Nahoku Hanohano Awards to his credit. He'll do a workshop on Nahimini noon to 2 p.m., as he just said, Saturday at Hanapepe Hawaiian Congregational Church. It's a free event. You can learn more about it at hpr2.org. Eia mako ka ohana, ke holo he ahai, e aloha.
Not everyone comes to HPR's website looking for program information. Some folks want to support the station but aren't quite sure how. Maybe you want to make a monetary contribution, or maybe you want to contribute time as a volunteer but don't know what kind of work is needed. Well, if you go to hawaiipublicradio.org and click on Support HPR, you'll find links to all different kinds of involvement. The HPR website, it's just a click away.
And while we're talking about support, the support that we get from station members is HPR's most reliable source of funding for day-to-day operations. By giving early for Challenge 2014, you're letting us know that you believe in HPR's mission and that you want to keep us on track for an 8-day spring campaign. We gratefully acknowledge Alan and Joni Tanaka of Honolulu, Leo Nakano of Pearl City, and Noriko Kasahara of Honolulu for your early gifts for Challenge 2014. Make your early gift by March 27th, and while you're at it, find out about HPR's Beijing Maybe Closer Than You Think sweepstakes. You can call us at 955-8821 during regular business hours, or follow the support link on hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting an evening of percussive dance, comedy, and original music with the troupe Rhythmic Circus, 7:30 tomorrow in Castle Theater, mauiarts.org.
Now an update to a reality check from last week about the nomination of Judge Michael Wilson to the Hawaii Supreme Court. Yesterday, the Hawaii State Bar Association submitted additional testimony. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair says the letter only raises more specific questions about whether he's qualified and suitable to be an associate justice. With today's reality check of a reality check, Chad Blair joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, reading through this letter that you have posted on the site and that was the basis for your article, yesterday. It really gives you a couple of clarifying statements, but not a whole lot. Do we really know any more than we did going in?
What the board has done, the board of directors for the bar, is they've identified what made them come up with an unqualified rating. Negative comments from lawyers. And it's all in one sentence. They have concerns regarding Wilson's work ethic, his lack of professionalism in the workplace. There's questions concerning what they describe as the propriety of conduct toward women in professional contexts. And that's it. There's no names. There's no dates. No further information. Having said that, this is more than what they provided to Clayton Hee's Judiciary Committee last week when the Senate basically sent the nomination to the full Senate for a vote. So more information, but nothing, if you will, no habeas corpus, no evidence to back it up.
It's one sentence out of a two-page letter.
That's right. And the rest of the letter focuses on how the board of directors reviewed its own policy and decided that, well, we can actually say a little bit more. The board actually met in special meeting on Tuesday, the outcome being this memo, which was sent to Senator Hee and the judiciary just yesterday. The governor, by the way, Governor Abercrombie, we asked him how he feels about this, and he said in a message, he remains confident of Mike Wilson's nomination to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so no changes there. You also tried to reach those 21 bar board members.
We did. And they are sticking to their confidentiality agreement that they cannot share any more information. We can tell you that Pat Malshimizu, she's the executive director for the bar, she says bar members take their job very seriously.
Right, as do we in trying to get information. Thanks, Chad. We'll talk
Thanks,
to you tomorrow.
Bethany.
Chad okay. Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square and raising some interesting questions about recent, outbursts at the Capitol.
Well, yeah, we don't need to really dance around this too terribly much because we're not just going to focus on what happened with Faye Hanohano and the young student who really took issue with how he was treated when he came to testify, or really looking at her specifically, although it has brought up a whole lot of conversation about what really is brewing underneath the surface and how we regard each other on a racial basis.
Yeah, I think that many of us could call similar incidents involving other people to mind. It was hardly could be considered isolated and an anomaly.
But it's one more opportunity for us to be able to look at it. And this is more than just what does it mean to be Haole in Hawaii? What does it mean to be anything in Hawaii?
Yeah, exactly. And we never are served by looking the other way on race. So candor is always the way to go, yeah?
Well, and how honest can we really be with each other when it comes to talking about race and how we treat each other in Hawaii? Mita Chesney Lind is going to be there with us tonight from UH, which is in the Women's Studies program. Also, John Osorio from Hawaiian Studies will be there and looking at some of what they see, some of how we talk to each other. And we're going to be taking your phone calls, too, so don't be shy.
I've always thought one of the really positive aspects of life in Hawaii was the ability to be candid about race and national origin, and we'll see if that holds true, yeah?
Well, it may be true if we want to poke fun at things and all enjoy a good laugh. I mean, Frank DeLima has made that his stock
yeah,
and trade,
there you
right?
Go, yeah.
But when we really want to get serious about it, some would say there is a tendency just to truly, as we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, dance around it and not look at it in the eye. And we're hoping we can start to do a little more of that tonight at 5.
Might have to challenge our own comfort level about a few things. Yeah.
Might, probably will.
Thanks, Beth Ann. That's tonight at 5 on Town Square.
And now moving on to another issue that a lot of us have been told we need to look squarely in the eye. Now, you know, it was on the governor's State of the State wish list and part of the joint majority package. And now bills are still moving in the legislature to give us a good look at what climate change could do to our state. Next week, there'll be a public hearing on HB 1714. It would create an interagency climate adaptation committee to assess the risks, impact, and economic consequences of climate change. Richard Walsgrove is the program director for the Blue Planet Foundation, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've been watching this because it was clearly on the governor's radar. It's been on a lot of people's radar for a lot of time. There is the temptation to say, are we looking at just studying something, or are we really going to get down and dirty with the one narrow issue of sea level rise?
That's a question everybody, I think, is asking. And we don't want the analysis by or paralysis by analysis scenario to happen. We certainly want people to focus in on important issues like sea level rise. At the same time, we have to recognize that climate change also impacts issues like fresh water, and it has implications for our economy and for energy and those sorts of things. So the bills that you mentioned, they're going to focus on sea level rise to start, but I think that's just a start, and everybody envisions this as a longer process to have something systemic. How do we address these climate impacts going forward?
But in this particular one, you know, we can't ignore the nexus of economic impact and sea level rise, because there is Waikiki and a lot of other beautiful places around shorelines in Hawaii.
Absolutely. I mean, we think about that economic impact, and we have to recognize, where does that come from? Well, it comes from the fact that we're impacting our ecosystem. It comes from the fact that we're impacting the infrastructure that already exists in these sorts of places, especially on the coast when we talk about sea level rise. And we're talking about impacting future infrastructure that might be built on or near the coast. And how does that impact tourism? And we can just go down the list. How does it impact agriculture, our water supplies? They're all tied together, and that's why this idea in the bill of having a larger group with lots of perspectives to come in and really give us the answers, the actionable things that the steps we can take today to adapt to climate change, I think is a good idea.
So that sort of looks off into the future and saying this is what we could do and perhaps what we should do, but there's also what's happening right now. So as you're looking at adaptation, don't you also have to look at mitigation of what's going on at this very moment?
Sure. It wouldn't make any sense to adapt to the impacts of climate change in the next 10, 20, 30 years without also asking ourselves, what are we doing today that is causing that climate change in the future, and what can we do to sort of stop those impacts? That's the mitigation question. One of the things that's been cooking for a long time in the state is reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. And we've got rules now sitting on the governor's desk that would require a reduction in carbon pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. We don't know why those rules haven't been signed yet, but we hope that soon we'll have these rules in place and that we're going to really be one of the leaders in reducing our greenhouse gas emissions in the state.
You really have no idea. There's been no feedback as to if there's something potentially wrong with them or if there's something that needs to be changed?
I don't know there's any official position on that yet. I mean, obviously, I think the governor's looked at this and has noted quite correctly that there are lots of rules that have to be signed, and that's a big stack of papers on his desk. On the other hand, we also know there are big industries in the state, the fossil fuel industries, the refineries, those sorts of folks, who probably aren't happy with the idea of being required to reduce their carbon pollution. And so I just don't know where in that mix things stand at the moment.
So in your opinion, is the governor more concerned with adaptation than mitigation?
I think it's too early to say. I mean, certainly the governor is behind these adaptation packages, and so we see support for that. You know, the Office of Sustainability in the governor's office would be involved in this House Bill 1714 we were talking about. I'm not sure whether or not mitigation is yet as high on the radar. We've got ideas like, let's make 100% of our energy system renewable by 2050. That was a bill that came up, and we've got, I think, support from the governor's office for those sorts of things. But, you know, it's a horse race still to see which one is ahead. And ultimately, we need both horses to cross the line together, because we have to deal with both sides of the problem.
Well, that's sort of my next question. Shouldn't these things be operating in tandem if you're trying to mitigate any future impact by simply taking care of what you can at this moment? Because we all know the future is somewhat unsure, but you do know what's going on right this minute.
They should operate in tandem, but then again, the only way to eat an alligator is one bite at a time. And so we're always asking that question of what's the next bite we take. I like the idea that adaptation is high on the list. We can't forget about mitigation.
What else is on the list that you think that we should be and could be doing right now?
On the mitigation side, you know, there are lots of things. Our energy infrastructure here in Hawaii, we know, is pretty dependent on oil, and we also burn coal, and we're talking about burning natural gas. I mean, these are the things that are causing climate change. And so we'd like to see every possible step taken to make sure that we're no longer going to rely on those sorts of energy sources.
And we've heard a lot of that before, Richard, but the idea of how we get to where we want to go always seems to be where we start, you know, poking fingers and in some cases paralyzing ourselves and not moving anywhere. So, you know, now, as you and I are both looking at each other and we're in March of 2014, is there something that you think that really could be done at this moment that we're not doing that really truly is feasible for us to do?
Sure. Let's build on our bright spots. We've seen solar energy as a huge bright spot in the energy landscape of the state over the past few years. But now we're coming up against this sort of barrier of how do we get more and more solar energy onto our grids.
Well, the barrier of a grid that can't handle it.
Right, right. So there are ideas on how to fix that. One of them would be a community solar program where you wouldn't have to put a solar panel on your own roof to benefit from it. You could put it anywhere on the grid, wherever it fit on the grid. There's a bill right now in in the legislature to make that sort of program work. I think that's the idea. That's one of these ways that we just keep removing barriers. We keep moving forward, build on our bright spots like solar, deal with the problem areas like adaptation, and altogether we've got the right package.
And on-bill financing for those people who would want to do it.
Coming this year, it's very exciting, the on-bill financing.
We talked a little bit about that, and if you want to hear more about it, there's the interview that we did last week, and it's on the archive. But in general, if you had to rate us, I mean, really with a very critical eye and sharp pencil, how would you rate Hawaii?
We're behind the curve in some respects. You know, Blue Planet Foundation actually released a report card last year on how we're doing on the energy side of things, that mitigation side of things. We were doing pretty well in areas like energy efficiency. I think because our energy costs are so high, people are conscious about using less of it. We're not doing so well in areas like transportation. How do we make our transportation system less fossil fuel dependent? We give ourselves the D minus on the transportation side of things. On adaptation, you know, we're one of the last coastal states to put together an adaptation plan for climate change. Hawaii is. So I think we're behind the ball on that one, but this Bill 1714.
Which brings us right back to the 1714.
Right.
The time frame on that one?
It's a little
were
bit,
it to pass?
Were it to pass, it's a little bit uncertain. I think that, you know, it's got funding in there for in 1 year for these reports, these plans to be made, and for actionable items to be recommended. The implementation is always the hard piece. So I think we would see hopefully some rapid action in the beginning, but we'll need a sustained effort to make sure all of those things are implemented over that same short time period.
Right, so we sort of don't have a conference high where we walk out and we do something great for a little while and then suddenly it falls off our radar.
Absolutely.
Richard, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Richard Walgrove. Walsgrove is an attorney and the program director for the clean energy nonprofit Blue Planet Foundation. He also holds a master's degree in chemical oceanography. You can have a look at HB 1714 up for a hearing next Tuesday. It's on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering the exceptional checking account, which includes an identity theft protection package that alerts users if personal information is compromised. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
And now we're going to walk back into the backyard and get you the answer to today's quiz. This morning, we took a look at a couple of Hawaii institutions of higher learning. In Honolulu, Chaminade University offers 23 undergraduate and 7 graduate programs and evening and weekend courses for working adults. It has 92 full-time faculty members and about 2,800 students. Out in La'ie, Brigham Young University, Hawaii, has about 2,500 students from 70 countries. Both were founded by religious orders, BYU by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Chaminade by the Catholic Marianist Order. Today, we asked you for their founding years. And this question was a twofer because both universities were founded in the same year, 1955. Now at 8:45, that's the answer to today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Nelson Bopp from Ohana Arts. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Here's an activity worth pouring some energy into: reading to kids and encouraging families to read aloud. So many writers and people who love words were lucky enough to have someone read to them when they were small, and they'll be giving some of that energy back this Saturday at the Honolulu Zoo. That's when local authors and storytellers will be stationed throughout the grounds reading aloud from zoo-themed books. Sue Cowing is one of the local authors looking forward to the event. She's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning.
What made you fall in love with reading?
Being read to when I was a child, particularly Aesop's fables and fairy tales, anything with a magic object in it.
Things that kind of took you on a little interior journey.
Yes.
What is it about those sort of fundamental stories that grab us when we were kids? What do you think are the elements that...
Well, I think we're basically a storytelling species, and it's amazing how stories stay alive through all the technology that we developed. And I think stories help us to become more human, and they help us to enjoy being human.
Do you sometimes feel that technology closes off the imagination by giving us all the pictures and sound, leaving us nothing to do?
Oh, it can, but I think one of the things about the Harry Potter books, one of the interesting things to me was that there's very little technology in it, and that's one of its appeals. If you want a fire, if you want light, you have to light a fire or a candle. There are no computers, and I think we long for that ability to create things ourselves.
Their runaway popularity was seen by many as a pretty good sign, wasn't it?
Well, it has all kinds of effects that we could spend an hour talking on. But I think there will always be a mixture of books. People will, even within one person, people will use technology, but they'll also want to curl up with a book rather than in some, for some uses, rather than, especially reading to children. That's kind of hard to curl up to a device.
Yeah, well, lucky for all concerned, yeah.
Anyway, we really got excited about Children's Literature Hawaii, the Honolulu Zoo Society, and the State Public Library System went together to create this event on Saturday.
What are you reading at the event?
I'm going to be by the elephant structure, so I'm going to be reading a lot of elephant books, but just all of us are choosing our favorite books to share with children that have to do with zoos and zoo animals. And the whole event is called Wild About Reading.
What are some elephant books? I immediately think of Babar the Elephant.
I'm not doing Babar, but there's one called Elephants Can Paint Too.
Uh-huh. That's
and
a new one.
And it turns out that our zoo actually wants people to donate art supplies for their elephants, so that's a nice connection.
That fits in pretty well.
And
yeah.
there's a wonderful a number of wonderful award-winning books about elephants, including the one and only Ivan, Elephants Aloft.
I like that title. It's kind of an evocative title, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
Have you touched on elephants in your own work for children?
No, I haven't. As a matter of fact, I haven't. But I am going to be in that area, so that's what I decided to do. But we're going to have five different areas with veteran storytellers and readers at all of them. And then on the main stage, we'll be having Wayne Watkins and his Howling Dog Band, a family-friendly band carrying on all day.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to be book giveaways. James Rumford's beautiful giraffe picture book called Chilin, A Giraffe's Journey is going to be given away by the hundreds.
Sue, was it pretty easy to round up storytellers and writers for this event?
Yes. It's mostly storytellers. A few of us are writers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In your own work for children, what are the kind of things that you try to bring out? I see you've got a book called You Will Call Me Drog.
Right.
And Poetry for Hawaii Kids, which involves the work of a number of authors.
No, that's only mine.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. I'm thinking of Fire in the Sea.
Fire in the Sea is an anthology that has none of my poems in it. But
well, tell me about My Dog Has Flies. That's a
Well, that's funny because, you know, the song for tuning your ukulele, My Dog Has Fleas,
yeah.
I decided to write about a boy who was tone deaf.
Uh-huh.
So that was the title poem. That one has a few animals in it. Mainly, that book was designed to bring poetry into Hawaii's children's experience because there weren't any anthologies like that. So it's sort of like a Shel Silverstein book, but for kids here with local references.
Have you done some reading aloud from that book for kids?
Oh, yes, many times, and also from the Drog book. Basically, what I try to do, and I think what a lot of writers try to do, is to write stories with serious hope in them and some humor.
That's a good point, leaving some hope at the end.
Yeah? Well, yeah, I think that's what you do when you write for children. And I think they are our hope, too, so I like to keep that alive.
Sure.
Yeah. And, you know, our Children's Literature Hawaii, the organization I'm working with, is devoted to bringing good books, connecting good books and children. And everyone loves animals, and there's so many wonderful animal books for children, so we thought, why not bring the books and the animals together at the zoo?
I think a lot of people who love reading have some of their best memories from childhood when they first read, you know, a great work of children's literature like A Wind in the Willows, where those characters come, you know, animal characters come so much to life.
Right.
I mean, I wonder if there's ever as much pleasure in reading as that first sort of innocent pleasure you get as a child.
Well, I think it does go on, and I think the important thing is to keep it alive. And I think that, you know, if, as a wonderful magazine editor for children said, if a book is good enough for children, it's good enough for everybody. I think we would subscribe to that.
Do you find when you go back and look at some of the real works of children's literature that you loved as a child, do they still hold up to an adult read?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And many of them can be read at several levels. You know, you enjoy it in a certain way as a child, but when you go back and read it, you say, oh, I see what that was about. I see what that theme was. And I haven't realized how much that has affected me.
Well, you could certainly say that about Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass, Wind in the Willows, among others. Yeah?
Right. Many, many. We're going to have a second related event on Saturday and Sunday. Barnes & Noble is having a book fair for Children's Literature Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
And they're bringing in the books. They've specially ordered the books that we're featuring at the zoo. And they will have those all together. And many of them would not normally be in the store. So it'll be a good chance for people to look over some wonderful zoo and zoo animal books.
So this is a very good opportunity if you have kids to give them an event to go to and even a place to go after.
Saturday and Sunday. Saturday while we're at the zoo, but also Sunday the next day. And online it will be the whole week.
Yeah, terrific.
But we hope people can get into the store. And if they use the ID number, then a percentage of everything they buy, including lattes, goes to support our biennial conference on literature in Hawaii.
So you really have a children's literature community.
Yes, we do.
Terrific.
Yes.
Sue, I really appreciate your talking with us. And
if anyone wants to know or get flyers on either of these things,
we'll send them your way through our website, Sue. Thanks
Alrighty.
Very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Sue Cowing is an author whose books include Fire in the Sea, an anthology of poetry and art, and My Dog Has Flies, Poetry for Hawaii's Kids. She'll be reading aloud to children at the Honolulu Zoo on Saturday. It's part of the Wild About Reading event. sponsored by the Hawaii State Public Library System and the Honolulu Zoo Society. It runs from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and details are at hpr2.org.
Hi, I'm Gene Evans, Community Outreach Manager at Your Hawaii Public Radio. March 27th is the deadline for the Beijing is Closer Than You Think sweepstakes. Hawaiian Airlines is offering 2 free round-trip tickets to Beijing as a way of encouraging you to pledge early for Challenge 2014. Early pledging means a shorter pledge drive, something we all can support. Contest rules and a donation form are at hawaiipublicradio.org, and thanks.
Beth Ann, it looks as if the Bar Association has tried to do a little bit of damage control about its attempts to sort of sink the nomination of Mike Wilson to the state Supreme Court, where they offered remarkably little evidence, and it doesn't look as if they are even reiterating their charges, have really offered much in the way of tangible evidence. Yeah.
Well, the 2-page letter and the one sentence that we talked about with Chad Blair a little earlier this morning points specifically to some things, yes, but not a lot of the why behind it or the basis on which they made those decisions, just saying these are our concerns and that's it, and this is why we would say he's not qualified.
You know, if it were coming from a less distinguished source, it might just be seen as a kind of smarmy innuendo because that's the way the language reads.
But as you know, the head of the State Bar Association Board says that, you know, we take our responsibility very seriously, and they don't want to compromise confidentiality. It's really a fine line there between trying to find out the right information on which to make a judgment and trying to protect people in a smaller community who feel that they might be threatened.
Once you open it up to anonymous charges, it's quite a slippery slope.
We're going to talk more about some slippery slopes tomorrow. For example, on our agenda, a bill that Hawaii's naturopathic physicians say isn't a good prescription.
And Jimmy Borges will join us to tell us about his upcoming big band barbershop event.
Meanwhile, you can talk back to your radio anytime you like, just the way we can hear you, which would be on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or you can tweet us at HI Conversation, or if you want to tweet me and I'll tweet back, I'm at BecauseHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, our links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandeker.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.